Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to At The Movies with me, Uma Fagan and PK Fagan. Now, I'm sure you get this question a lot. Pick your three favourite movies, or what are your top five of all time? It's a difficult one. More so if you're like me or Matt, who's here with me. If you're someone who watches a lot of film, who loves movies irrespective of genre, picking favourites is almost an impossibility. That being said, I can tell you one thing, which is that the movies of John McTiernan would almost always make it into any one of my lists. Die Hard, Predator, The Hunt for Red October, The Thomas Crown Affair, Last Action Hero, what a filmography. Today on At The Movies, I'm premiering a new occasional recurring segment which takes a look back at the cinematic careers of some incredible directors. And today, it's the work and legacy of John McTiernan, or what I like to call Why Die Hard is the Best Movie of All Time. Joining me today to talk John McTiernan and, well, Die Hard, is fellow film buff Matt Armitage. So, Matt, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Uma.
John McTiernan.
Yeah.
So this was your suggestion, because I said, hey, I want to do this show featuring legendary directors or great directors. And we started off talking about Brian De Palma, and then you sent me this WhatsApp just going, John McTiernan. And I was like, yes.
Well, yeah, because I started thinking more about the films that I actually watched during, you know, kind of my late teens and early 20s. And I hadn't actually really made the connection before. I like came up with this, you know, some of these really great films. And suddenly I realized, oh, actually, they're all by John McTiernan. You know, the Die Hard, Last Action Hero, Thomas Crown Affair, even 13th Warrior, which, I mean, we'll probably talk about the fact that everyone hates that movie.
I love that film.
Exactly. You know, it's great fun. So I thought, yeah, John McTiernan's got to be the guy we do today.
Can we just say, though, right off the bat, yes, he's done these series of action movies, and that's what he's known for. But yet, every action movie feels like a separate genre. And that's what I like most about his films. You watch Predator, right?
Yeah.
And apart from that opening shot where an alien spaceship shoots this probe to Earth, you'd be hard-pressed to remember that it's a science fiction movie.
Absolutely. And I watched that film again recently. And, you know, the special effects, everything about it is terrible.
It's kind of awful.
Yeah, it's kind of awful. But it's still a great movie. And I think people also forget that it was a very low budget film. I think it cost around $15 million US. It took over $100 million at the box office. It was a massive success.
But it was only his second movie. I think he had done Nomads in 1986.
Yeah, he did Nomads. Yeah, that's right.
And then this one was in 1987.
Yeah. And of course, Schwarzenegger was not a massive star at that point. I mean, I think he'd done Commando and, you know, the smaller stuff before. He was, you know, he was the Van Damme of his era at that point. He wasn't a superstar action hero.
Sorry, yet. Matt, even that reference ages you a great deal. He was the Van Damme of his era.
Well, I could have said Steven Seagal. Or Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's slightly more current. I would have said maybe he's the Dwayne Johnson. He's the Rock of his era.
No, because I think The Rock never quite got into that same place, because The Rock always played it very camply. And Schwarzenegger only came to the camp stuff later on.
Oh, much later.
Yeah. I mean, I think The Rock was always looking at that camp aspect of Schwarzenegger's career. He wasn't looking at the Van Damme end of the spectrum.
Predator is an interesting movie because the story is so basic, right? These army guys, they're in the jungle. They're out to do a hunt, essentially, but they find out that they're the victim of this creature on an interstellar safari. It's such a basic plot line. And what makes the movie work so well is the scripting, the banter. The movie is so compelling, and it falls into all of these categories of horror, thriller that work so well, that keep you engaged and entertained right up till the end.
It's also because it's a small movie. The cast is small. They set it in the jungle, so you never get wide vistas. You get all these things. The predator is always peering through the foliage and the undergrowth. So you get that claustrophobic feeling about it as well. So, and again, a lot of that comes down to the fact that it was a low budget movie. You know, they're doing an awful lot with not very much. So when you think about the Predator, special effects, I mean, they're expensive now, but they were colossally expensive then. So of course you try and do it through the eyes of the Predator rather than showing it on screen, because...
And you just use thermal imaging.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you just turn everything green and fantastic. Hey, presto. Predator works because, you know, he encloses you in the space. So he is very effective at sort of cutting you off from the rest of the world and focusing your attention just on what's going on, you know, literally within what you can see with your eyes. You're not so concerned with what's happening beyond that. And even with Last Action Hero, he does exactly the same by setting it inside a fictional film world, which has all of these rigid parameters. You know, nobody can leave the city. Nobody has ever left the city. Nobody even wants to leave the city. He's very good at controlling environment. And as you say, he's very effective with dialogue.
And that's what makes Predator work so well. There's nothing else going for that movie except for the fact that it has a good, solid script.
But I wonder if that's one of the issues that he faces, that his movies are not necessarily intelligent, but his dialogue is smart. So I wonder if that kind of puts him in a place where, you know, it's not a straightforward, dumb action movie. But at the same time, it's not something that the kind of intellectuals can get behind either. And again, take Last Action Hero. He tried to do something very, very clever in quite a dumb format. And again, I think that fell flat with a lot of the reviewers.
I have no idea why that movie was panned as much as it was. I watched that again just before we did this recording, and it is so meta.
Yeah.
Wes Craven gets a lot of credit for Scream, right? Scream came out in 1996, and it was very clever what Wes Craven did. It was a really cunning way to dissect and, you know, just deconstruct the horror genre. You know, why do people keep running up the stairs whenever someone's in the house? Why don't they just run out of the house? And he made fun of that, and he played with it. But in 1993, John McTiernan does exactly that with Last Action Hero.
Absolutely, and he doesn't only do it with action movies as a genre. He does it to his own films as well.
I mean, he does it with Hollywood in general.
Yeah. But you know, he's quite happy to put himself as part of, you know, that environment and rip himself apart as well.
And I don't know if watching Last Action Hero now imbues it with a certain sense of nostalgia, because that movie is an homage. It came out in the 90s, and it's an homage to the movies we grew up watching, the action movies we grew up watching in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
And it makes you feel like a kid again, that sense of magic of the lone hero, the Steven Seagal, if you will, wandering through the streets, capturing the bad guy at all costs. And yeah, he completely tears it apart with this film. And it was so... And it's genius to get Arnie to do that as well, because you're in 1993 and Arnie's both at the at the peak, so he's about to hit the wane of his career, and it's the perfect person to play that role. It's almost like George Clooney in Hail Caesar.
It's a movie for adults, but the hero is a kid. You know, it doesn't fit into any pigeonhole. Is it a comedy? Yes, it is a comedy, but it's not quite a straightforward comedy. It's a satire, but it's not that sharp or biting in the way. I mean, it's quite an affectionate takedown of Hollywood when you think about it. I mean, there's the lovely scene when Arnold's character comes out, or Jack Slater comes out of the Hollywood world and into reality, and he puts his hand through the window of a taxi or something
bleeding.
Like that, and he starts bleeding, and he says, "Ow!" You know, he's never experienced
pain.
Yeah, but he hasn't experienced pain before. This whole idea, this concept is alien to him.
The 13th Warrior is a very small movie by comparison. It's Antonio Banderas. It's based on Eaters of the Dead, which is a novel by Michael Crichton. And
loosely based on Beowulf.
Right? And it's about Vikings and Arab interpreter, writer.
Yeah, who is Antonio Banderas, because he's got slightly dark skin.
And also, you know, he was hot at the time. He was
he was the big star then.
He was the big star. Yeah. And let me tell you what sold that movie for me. And it is the most ridiculous thing that sold that movie for me. But there's this one scene early in the film when he's camping out with the Vikings. Mm. And they're all speaking Viking language, which he doesn't understand. Yeah. And it's a really well-shot scene as to how, because, you know, he's a writer and he's an interpreter, and how he amalgamates that language. He kind of takes it all in and then slowly begins to understand what they're saying and then starts talking to them.
Yeah.
And everyone's kind of floored. And in that moment, it's such a very quick and effective way to overcome this hurdle of, you know, linguistic translation.
And I think that also goes back to what I was saying about his movies being smart, but not necessarily taken as being intelligent. Because that was, you know, that could have been botched very, very easily. It's a very difficult thing to get the concept of somebody, you know, slowly coming to understand a language one word at a time, or two or three words at a time. And that sequence is done fantastically well. And it's actually very believable.
Thomas Crown Affair, the remake with Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo, and it came out in 1999. And, of course, it's a remake of the Steve McQueen movie. I'm going to say something incredibly controversial. I actually prefer the remake to the original.
I haven't even seen the original.
Have you not? Okay, I prefer the remake to the original for one reason. In the original, Steve McQueen doesn't actually do the robbery. Hmm. He doesn't do the heist. He's a rich millionaire who pays a bunch of people to do this heist. It's such an interesting take for an old movie, because they have all these people doing the heist, and then McQueen is sitting in his living room laughing maniacally while this is happening. And it's such a weird thing to watch with a modern sensibility. It's so dated. Meanwhile, with the Pierce Brosnan version, what McTiernan does is he slicks it up. This is a cool, sexy, just clever heist movie.
Oh, absolutely. And it's still very knowing, and it's still played for laughs. There's always that undercurrent. I mean, Rene Russo spends most of the movie with a half smile or smirk on her face. You know, she's
little clothes.
Of course. I mean, she's doing her best to catch Pierce Brosnan, but, you know, you can just see that everyone's more amused by it than anything else.
And it's smart. It's smart. She is one of the smartest heroines of the 90s, I think. I keep telling people she was the best Pierce Brosnan Bond girl, because she matches him wit for wit in this movie.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, she doesn't give a centimetre or an inch. That set piece at the end when they're actually replacing the artwork back in the gallery, and all of the bowler-hatted men, and you get the Nina Simone track coming in.
Cinnamon,
yeah. It's atmospheric, it's tense, it's taut.
But, and it's clever.
And it's really, really clever. I mean,
I remember watching this in the cinema. I remember taking my mom and dad to watch this film. And when that happened, there was this audible, not gasp, but knowing laugh from everyone who just went, oh, that was good. I mean, that's how you interpret that moment.
Absolutely. And, you know, it really is mind-boggling how they actually filmed that sequence. I cannot conceive of how they managed the choreography. I mean, the number of reshoots to get that scene with all the bowler hats going off in different directions, because there's a symmetry to it as well. It's not just clever. There's that symmetry. There's that mathematical precision to it that's very, very interesting.
All right, it's time to talk Die Hard. I'm really going to call this show, I'm really going to call this episode Why Die Hard is the Best Movie of All Time. It is at least the best Christmas movie of all time. Miracle on 34th Street, whatever.
Well, Bad Santa.
Okay, Bad Santa's pretty good. But Die Hard, man. You know what's interesting about Die Hard? Die Hard is one of these movies which is probably impossible to recreate. It is, in my opinion, like Ghostbusters or Casablanca, where on paper it just doesn't feel like it should work. And yet it is a series of accidents, which is the accidental casting of Bruce Willis. It was supposed to be Sinatra. Did you know that?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Right? Sinatra, aging Frank Sinatra, actually snubbed it. He was contractually obliged to be in Die Hard. Then Harrison Ford turned it down. Sylvester Stallone turned it down. Don Johnson turned it down. Because, you know, those three guys were super hot at the time.
Yeah.
Bruce Willis was just being a goof on Moonlighting.
Gosh, I would like to have seen Don Johnson doing that movie.
It would have been awful.
It would have been awful, but it would have been the campest and cultist film ever made.
So that's an accident. The fact that Alan Rickman apparently had only been in LA for 2 days when they gave him that script, and he didn't want to do it because he was like, you know, I'm a Shakespearean actor. Yeah. I don't do action movies. I can't do an Alan Rickman voice. But no, even he agreed to do this movie, and it was all these series of accidents that somehow came together to make this brilliant action film that everyone keeps trying to emulate till today.
Again, sorry to keep going back to this point, but Die Hard is also a small movie. All of the action takes place in very enclosed spaces. There's quite a lot of the...
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of the movie that is dedicated to him sitting in that closet or cupboard, speaking to the deputy police chief on the walkie-talkie. You don't do that in an action movie. You don't have extended sequences
where he's just crawling through an air vent.
Yeah, and that scene where he has to walk across the broken glass in the room with bare feet. That is one of the most excruciating sequences that I've ever seen. I mean, forget, you know, Saw and all the torture porn movies. That was just, you know, your hand is over your mouth trying to stifle your own gasps. And the thing is, you know he's got to go across the entire room. So it's not just, you're not going to be cutting your feet once.
Everything in that movie is so tight. That moment is earned because 30 minutes earlier, he has to lose his shoes. And everything is earned. Well, you don't have to suspend too much disbelief. I mean, there is the disbelief of one guy taking down a terrorist army, but...
Of course.
Yeah, but, you know, he's a hero. But, yeah, he takes off his shoes. The way he gets his gun. The way Hans Gruber discovers that Holly's his wife. I mean, all of these moments are earned, whether through a throwaway line or a glimpse at a photo frame or something. But the fact is that everything is so well thought out and so tight.
Yeah,
you know, they don't do that very much in action movies right now. Every time you see an action movie, you walk out going, oh, you know, I have to suspend disbelief. That's fine. It's an action movie.
Yeah, or more specifically, we're told why.
Precisely.
1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing with Die Hard is the scripting was so tight as well. So even with the scripting of this film and the way they outline both Hans Gruber and John McClane, they're very similar characters. But when you think about it, the reason you hate Hans Gruber... it's probably because he kills innocent people. That's the only thing that really separates the two of them. It's because Hans Gruber's an incredibly likable bad guy.
Yes, he is. But he's also set up... I mean, this is at the end of the kind of yuppie era. And he's set up very much as a yuppie terrorist.
Correct.
You know, he's very slick and clean cut. Whereas you've got Bruce Willis, who's the kind of working man. Yes, they do have a lot of similarities. They're both probably borderline psychopaths who can't form human relationships. But they're coming from very different perspectives. And I think you also have that element that they've chosen to take over this big corporation. But Bruce Willis isn't interested in saving the big corporation. He's just interested in saving his wife and, from the ego perspective, taking down the bad guy.
There's a massive amount of stuff that makes this movie work. There's cinematographer Jan de Bont and his decisions with lighting in this film and how that adds this energetic, claustrophobic feel. There's the score by Michael Kamen, which is just intense and keeps you pulsing and pounding throughout this movie. There's a lot. And of course, there's Bruce Willis. There's Bruce Willis with that charm, that weird, strange comedy, intense situations that Don Johnson would never be able to pull off.
No, and Frank Sinatra, I can't even...
Can you imagine that? I can't even imagine. Aging Frank Sinatra as an action hero?
But going back to what you were saying about the lighting as well, I mean, yes, it's very rare that you see an action movie that is dark. I mean, you see it a lot more now. I mean, I think this kind of set the trend. But action movies, you know, traditionally, things would be quite light because you want to see the explosion and you want to see the punch and all of these things. You don't typically do them, or at that point, you didn't typically do them in darkened rooms. Even in the, you know, even in the rooms where they are supposedly well lit, it's very mood lighting. It's spotlights on potted plants. There's a lot of shadow and a lot of dark space to crawl in and out of. And of course, there's all the, as you said, the, you know, he's crawling in the boxes. There's the scene with Gruber's bodyguard where they're fighting with the pulley down in the basement. All of this stuff happens in the dim, dank depths of this building.
Correct. Do you have a favorite McTiernan movie?
Gosh, I think it's probably Last Action Hero, although I do have a soft spot for the Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Which is probably the best sequel, actually.
Yeah, no, it is the best sequel, without a shadow of the doubt, because it's giving a counterfoil to Bruce Willis in the shape of Samuel L. Jackson, someone who can actually give the dialogue back arguably better than Willis does it as well. And also because it has some fantastic comedic moments in it. I mean, there's the scene on the ship where a steel cable cuts a guy in half. And, you know, that should be a horrific scene. But then when you see them dragging the body away and each of them's dragging a different half. I remember watching that in the cinema and the entire audience erupting with laughter. But that should have been a very tense moment when everyone gasps and goes, ooh, but, you know, he just subverts it and plays it completely for laughs.
Well, obviously, Die Hard.
Die Hard, yes.
But if you're not talking about Die Hard, because I watch that movie at least two times a year. Anyway, if you're not talking about Die Hard, then probably Thomas Crown Affair. Because it's very rare that someone takes a classic, which is what the Steve McQueen movie is or was, and adapts it, modernizes it, and actually puts it on par, if not makes it better. That is a tough job. I mean, we see how people failed with Psycho and any kind of remake of a classic, right? And no, Thomas Crown Affair is just a brilliant piece of re-movie making. So yeah, tell us what your favorite John McTiernan movie is. Have you embraced the wonder and magic of Die Hard? You can tweet me on @UmaPagan or @TheMoviesMY. Matt, you are on.
I am on @CulturePop. That's KulturPop. Sorry, CulturePop up.
Try and remember your Twitter address.
Yeah,
I know you
it's
don't
terrible.
Use it much.
I don't
Come
use it very
on.
Much. Actually, the best thing to do is just get me on Instagram. I'm @CulturePop on Instagram.
There you go.
Also, that's where I live.
Also with a K. Matthew, thank you very much once again for coming on and talking to me about John McTiernan.
Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to At The Movies. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during red, white, and blue savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.